Welcome to the Darlington Podcast, a production of Darlington School in Rome, Georgia. Join us as we take a look inside and outside our classrooms and connect with students, teachers, alumni, and more.
Hello, I'm Brent Bell, head of school at Darlington, and I want to welcome you to Conversations by the Lakeside. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Stefan Eady, Assistant Head of School for Academic Affairs and longtime member of the Darlington faculty. Stefan, thanks for being with us today.
It's my pleasure, Brent. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Excited to get started and hear a little bit more from you. Why don't we jump right in and tell us a little bit about when you came to Darlington and why you found your way to Darlington School.
So I came to Darlington in January of 97. I was a mid-year and graduated from Barry. That's how I got nearby, and I had someone from Barry tell me about the job. One of my mentors over there, I was working in the alumni office, and Barry offered me a job. And Darlington offered me a job, but Darlington offered me $1,000 more.
Okay.
So Darlington got me. So here I am. Darlington also like called me back a little bit more than Barry, so that was also good. So I try to remember that. I try to call our candidates back nowadays a little bit more.
Well, that's good. So tell us, what was that first job in 1997? Because here we are at in 2025, and you're still here. So what was... What was that first position?
I was a baby. I was 22 years old. I just hired some 22-year-olds from Barry, which is really fun and sort of jarring in a way. And because I relate to them, I think. And I had a really fancy title, Assistant Director of Communications. So hired mid-year to do that, helped Bill Bug out, who was the Director of Communications at the time. And didn't know what I was going to do, and ended up just doing a little bit of everything. First press release I wrote was about my own hire, which I thought was really funny, so I kept that. It's in the scrapbook. And 10% of my job was supposed to be working on the new Darlington website. So I did that for a few years. Worked on the magazine and Lakeside Lines and all things that came out of communications.
Okay, great. Well, trace us... from your journey from that point in time to today, what have been the different roles you've had at the school? Maybe some highlights of that journey in terms of accomplishments and things that you're proud of along the way. It's been obviously over 25 years now, and you've done lots of things and made a huge contribution to the life of the school. So share a little bit about that from your perspective.
Sure. I don't feel... It's not pride or accomplishments or anything like that, but it's always been a place to grow and get better. And I tell people, especially new people we're talking to who are coming, and they ask great questions like, why are you still here? Like you just asked. And I'll just say things like, you know, there was always something else to do. There's always some new way to help, some new way to grow. And I, you know, over the years, I just said yes to a lot of things. I just said yes all the time. I looked for ways I could help, looked for ways I could be useful. I think that's sort of a theme just in my life. I said 10% of the job was web development. And, I think David Hicks he came in 99 as a president, and I was just sitting in a faculty meeting, like everybody else when he announced his goals 2000, which was, start the house system, start the academy program, and put everything online. So in 2003, Bob Rogers, who was the business office manager at the time and was in charge of communications office, I had a little talk with him. He was great. He was a good mentor along the way. So I pointed out to him that we didn't have an IT department. We had a couple of random sort of people who did some IT things. So he said, great. You're right. We could use that. It's time for an IT department, and congratulations, you're in charge. And I said, are you sure? And he said, yes. And I said, yes. I said, yes. I kept saying yes over the years. So I was IT director for a long time, my longest standing role, probably for about 18 years. And even in that role, just said yes a lot. People thought I was crazy. I just said yes to everything. I said yes to taking over the phone system. Like, why would you do that? Well, it let us buy a whole new network for the school and take us to a place that was better. When we had to tried to figure out like how computers were going to go and laptop programs and all that. You know, pulled faculty together and built teams and figured out ways to, you know, just keep saying yes. So that was a very meaningful, impactful role for a long time. And then I guess you came along 2016 and asked me to do a few more things, be assistant head of school for academic resources. And that was really nice of you. And then you let me continue to be IT director. So you're welcome. I just kept doing all that as well. But I did the assistant head role there for a little while through the pandemic, which was quite an experience. And we can talk about that if you want to. And then after that, you sort of enhanced that assistant head of school role to what it currently is. So for the last 4 years, I've been assistant head of school for academic affairs.
All right, great. Well, let's go back to a couple things to highlight in your tenure here. What would you want the listeners to know or to learn a little bit about Darlington being a one-to-one school and maybe our relationship with Apple? If there's anything interesting in terms of how that came about or the process that you all engaged in, because I would say From my seat, certainly Darlington's engagement with technology is a signature aspect of the student experience and really the faculty experience as well. And you've had a lot to do with that.
One thing that was important to me with the technology program was not the technology per se, but just how it helped support the mission of the school. So I actually got a lot of pressure back in those days to start a laptop program, to put laptops in the hands of students, and I actually said no a lot then because we weren't quite ready for it. We did carts and we did those kind of things. We had Windows machines, and I kind of just waited for things to come to a head. And when they finally did, the moment showed itself as a need to have a laptop in everybody's hands because of the way we were integrating technology. So it was actually more about the program and the curriculum and how this tool was being used more and more and more on a daily basis that then necessitated the need for a one-to-one program. So it was that sort of perspective that I tried to make sure we were keeping in the technology world. And so when we switched to the one-to-one program, we became a Mac school at that point. We'd been a Windows school. I can tell you no one in my IT department wanted to switch to Apple. That wasn't going to be fun. But the users wanted Apple, and it made sense. That was what was the right thing for the school. And so we made that happen. That was probably back in 2010, 2011. But again, we led with a strategic plan. We led with a technology integration program, a curriculum that we still have in place, although it's been updated many times. But it's just about what are the skills that the student needs to use? What are the ways we're going to deliver our learning? And what is the purpose of that device and its role in all of that? So it worked out great. The relationship with Apple was sort of secondary in a way. I mean, we chose the device that we thought would be best to the user, and we developed a great relationship with Apple along the way because of that. Apple philosophically, at least in those days, and they continue to be very much involved in thinking about education and not just selling devices, although that's certainly their main way of operating as a company. But they embraced thinking about pedagogy, and challenge-based learning was new back then. And they helped us network with other schools and helped teach us best practice. We worked with them to develop programs. So it was a good partnership.
Excellent. And tell us a little bit about the development of Darlington's website. And really, I think what's interesting to me is where did you develop the skills to develop that website?
Yeah, I don't own the way. Like, I don't know. I get asked that question some. I mean, I was always sort of an I guess I was always a coding type person. You know, it probably goes back to I have this story that may sound familiar to some where, you know, he got a computer. I got a computer when I was very young, in third or fourth grade. My dad was a salesman. He came home with this computer that he had won in a sales contest. He didn't know what to do with it, and he gave it to me. So I started playing around with it. Computers back in, well, let's see, this would have been when I was 8 or 9 years old. So they didn't do much unless you knew how to write programs. So I learned how to write simple, basic programming. So I had those, those hours and hours of work. But then when I worked at Barry, in the alumni office I mentioned earlier, I created their first alumni website, class notes and things like that, that was online. I think that's part of how I got the job here. So that helped a lot. And so I brought that here. The first websites were just like brochures on a screen. I was more interested in like how we can make them interactive. Got a lot of questions like, how hard would it be? How hard would it be to put the directory on our page? How hard would it be to put grades online? I was a teacher writing comments on 5 layers of carbon paper, and I didn't have as many students as a full-time teacher, but my hand still hurt after that. So I was just as eager to create a better way to do things as anybody else. So in some ways, it just started with those kind of things, and then just spiraled completely out of control. Brent, we just solved every problem with the website. The website can fix it, or how hard would it be? Those kind of things. But it was a good thing. Darlington is a very, unique place. Being a boarding school, a day school, a pre-K through 12 school, a substantial athletics program, arts program, academics are rigorous. Does a lot of things. So it's hard to find a one-stop solution to do all that, but we were able to create a lot of solutions, and it was gratifying over the years to solve a lot of problems for the school through the website.
Yeah, it's been a great asset for the school for many years for sure. So as you've transitioned to your current role as assistant head for academic affairs. We'll talk about a couple of specific things here in a minute, but share a little bit with our listeners. What does that mean? What is that role in your mind? What are the priorities there for you?
So when you asked me to do this role, it's been about 4 years ago, I think now, I roughly looked at the job description, but I think I'll more, if you remember, said, if this position lets me help faculty, I'll do it. It's always been about that. Like, what can I do to help the faculty? Which in turn helps every student that's at Darlington. Whereas I saw a lot of opportunity over the years, and IT seems a little more black and white, I think that was similar. I think I saw a lot of opportunity for working with our faculty in a better way and supporting them in a better way, giving them a really great experience so they could do the same for our students. And then I read the job description and I was like, okay, we can do this. I can work with this, which involved, managing or hiring the faculty, like making sure the faculty were intact, in place, equipped, given a sense of direction, knew which way they were moving, knew what was expected of them, and given the resources to do that. So that was the most exciting part to me. The curricular piece was there too. And curriculum, it means a lot of different things, and people who are listening to this may have their own definition of curriculum. But for me, it was just about, what's the academic program look like? What are the expectations? What are the things that make it consistent? So what are we teaching in every class? How does it line up? It's ongoing work in terms of that, but it does come down to like, what is the academic program and how are we executing it and how we're getting the results that we want with our students? And then the last part was really about the strategy of the school. So in terms of growth, forward direction, continuing to make sure we're staying relevant, we're still addressing issues. It was thinking about the strategic direction of the school, implementing it, thinking about the strategic plan. Things may not seem that exciting, but there's really some are great things that came out of that in terms of trying to become more of a data-centered school, for example, and that has a real impact to some of the decisions that we're making today.
Excellent. So let's talk a little bit about hiring. Obviously, we agree certainly philosophically that essentially schools are in the people business. A student-centered school is also a faculty-centered school. And that obviously everyone needs to be supported so that they can do their best possible work. One of the things that you've done since taking on the position is revamping the hiring process. Maybe you could share a little bit with our listeners. I think people would be interested to hear how we go about hiring new members in the school community and teachers perhaps in particular.
Sure, sure. I have learned there's an art to it. Learned the hard way. And we put a lot of energy and effort into it. I think number one, I would say we take a team approach. And that's not a necessarily a standard or a best practice, but I think it works really well for Darlington. It means bringing in the people who would know best about the position that's open, who would work closely with the position that's open, who cares and has the time and wants to put in some time to do the work in terms of, you know, all the things that we might see more familiar, working with resumes and talking with people, doing those kind of things. So we take a team approach. We literally put a team together for every position. It's led by one person. It's often a department head, but not always. Usually has somebody from the department, but it has somebody from other departments on there as well. It just depends on the position. It's doing a lot of talking, a lot of engaging, both with the person and with people who know that person. We never hire somebody who doesn't come to campus. Sometimes it's virtual. We've had to do that a few times with a teacher that lives in Taiwan or in Europe or something like that. But there is a great effort put to find out how well they're going to fit with the community. So that's best done if they're here in person working with the community. And we never hire a teacher who hasn't first been in front of our students. And we try to create opportunities to observe them with our students, both in a formal classroom setting and an informal, you know, I period or exploratory or club or advisory or something like that.
What would you say are the biggest challenges in the hiring process?
Certainly similar challenges that many people who have to hire face. So good people who want to work in Rome, who want to work at a school, who match the mission of the school and can do it for a salary that Darlington can pay or that school can pay, can make the move. Economic times are tough. So those are really the biggest challenges. I feel like once we find somebody who can kind of fit those, or find a group of people that can fit those kind of things, then we're kind of off to the races. We're ready to whittle it down and find the best person for the job. And that's where I get excited, just trying to find the best person for the job. So we had harder times, you know, post-pandemic, and cost of living gets tough, even here in Rome, Georgia. Sometimes it's just, is there a place to live at certain times there? Those are challenges. But the nice thing is, you know, Darlington has a really great reputation as being a good place to work. I feel like we've become an even better place to work in the last few years. That's a little maybe biased on my part, but it is a really great place to work. The new faculty tell me that over the last 2 or 3 years. So if we can find somebody who, you know, matches all those things, I think we're in good shape. I think maybe the most significant change has been, not that the hiring process has changed a lot, although all the things I said are true and are changes, but it's just that we recognize that the hiring is just the beginning. So finding someone great is wonderful, and you make a little toast and a fist bump, and then you get right back to work. So we've overhauled the onboarding process, the orientation process for new faculty. We had department heads who have a revised job description taking care of those people, and mentors, division heads have different responsibilities now. So there's lots of support and there's lots of care taken with faculty. There's PLCs that we put new faculty through. There's just a lot that we try to do to make sure that the faculty have a good onboarding experience and then continue to have a good experience as they become more veteran members of the faculty.
Yeah, once you have someone here, obviously you want to retain them and you want them to grow and enjoy their work and also feeling like there's, you know, opportunity to continue to improve. And I think that's, you know, one of the core operating principles of the school is to make sure that not only the students but the adults are supported in their efforts here. You mentioned several enhancements to the program there. Any other enhancements to the academic program you'd want to point out to our listeners?
I'd say, you know, over the past few years, trying to make the curriculum a bit more concrete and trying to create some more clear expectations in regard to who's responsible for what. We think, you know, if you look on our website, you can dig into it a little bit and find something called the cycle of learning. And so just having those clear sort of common framework, everybody understands the same thing about what we're trying to do and why we're doing it. Looking at that cycle of learning, it talks about curriculum, it talks about the teacher's responsibility, the student's responsibility. So the curriculum is the school's responsibility. And that hasn't always been the case at independent schools. And that a teacher might have just been told to teach Algebra 2 and go do it. And we don't do that anymore. We haven't done that for a while. The school has a responsibility to know what's going to be taught in that Algebra 2 class. The teacher has a responsibility to know how to make sure that group of students is given the right experiences to learn that material the best. And the student has a responsibility to show up and be involved and engaged and put in the work in their part too. You know, I do feel like we've done a lot of work in regards to that, and I think that's brought consistency to the program across the departments, across teachers. Whether they're new, whether they're experienced and veterans and been here for 40 years or 30 years or 20 years or 1 year, we're actually doing a better job at delivering a more consistent experience there, which I think is really great. You know, this year we have a lot of changes in terms of the technology. We're talking about technology a lot today. But through those changes, I think that those consistencies have helped us to get through them a little more easily. And that our teachers know what the simple expectations are, which is that the students have a great experience, number one, and that they're going to have great outcomes, number two. They're going to learn.
Excellent. We obviously, you know, Darlington is a college preparatory school. We say that over and over again. And we talk a lot about in the cycle of learning having a skills-based curriculum. In your mind, how does the idea of a skills-based curriculum tie into being a college preparatory school? How are those things connected in your mind?
Well, a skills-based curriculum, in a large part, is focused on what can a student do, what can they do at the end of the class that they couldn't do at the beginning, or what can they do better? And it also focuses on core things. And so we have core skills in terms of the things that you might associate with traditional schooling, in terms of reading and writing and analytical thinking, that we can now tie across disciplines. And we can have discipline-specific skills, so we can work at both of those levels. So I think in terms of, you know, getting a student ready for college or life, however you want to look at it, you know, any student coming through Darlington is going to come out equipped better at the end to not only, you know, have the transcript and, you know, have the grade and say they did it, but they're actually going to be better at being a student, but also better at life. Our teachers are just as concerned about you know, how capable a student can be rather than just can they do what you tell them to do.
Yeah, great, excellent. So change of pace here a little bit. Let's talk about Stefan, the individual.
Oh, the most fascinating part of the podcast.
It is fascinating, and we're going to start with, I wouldn't even call it a hobby, but you're a long-distance runner.
Yes.
And so what does that mean in your world, a long-distance runner? The farthest you've run in one occasion is how far?
100 miles.
100 miles.
People ask me, did you run the whole way? No, the answer is no, I didn't. I stopped and had a little snack. Stop and use the bathroom. I stop and sit down. My legs hurt. But in one go, I propelled myself at least across those 100 miles.
Yeah. And is that considered an ultra marathon?
Yes.
Okay. And how did you become an ultra marathoner?
Slowly and by surprise. Perhaps. I took the gradual approach. So one of my old mentors here, Rick Bice, would have behind him on the wall these 13 marathon bibs, and I thought that was really cool. And he asked me if I wanted to run 10K with him, which was the Peachtree Road Race, which probably a lot of people listening have if not participated in know about.
So you've taken this journey from 6.2 miles to 100 miles.
Yeah.
Gradually, incrementally, suddenly, whatever it all feels like. What do you learn about yourself running 100 miles?
Part of the reason I got into ultra, that word sounds really
impressive.
Yeah, right. But
the word you're looking for is impressive. Yes.
Meant to. I don't know that it should
more than a marathon.
That's it, right? That's all it means. But the really cool stuff was more than a marathon. That got you off the road. It got into the trails. It put you in the mountains. And it also put your body in a place that a marathon wouldn't put it into. So at first, it started off as just a way to see better trails, a way to see if I could go farther because I had done the marathon. So what else is there? And then the trails started having mountains, and then I met a group of friends that were really cool that did that, and that friends can get you into trouble. And I've had a lot of good friends that got me into a lot of bad trouble with these things, in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of on reflecting, there's probably two things, that I've learned about myself or about life. One of them is gratitude. This is going to sound a little cheeky, but it is. One's gratitude. And so in lots of ways, gratitude for, my health to be able to do these things is remarkable. Gratitude for just a world that has trails like this. I've seen some remarkable places that people will never get to see because you have to go 50 miles on foot to see the top of that mm-hmm. mountain. Which is really great. You have to have support to do these things. So a wife and family, Carrie, who put up with me. The hardest part of an ultra is not the race necessarily, it's the training and the time to get ready for it. Friends who do that training with me, but they literally show up, for those 100 mile races, I've got a group of buddies who are literally there taking care of me, running with me, for miles and miles through the woods to help with that. You couldn't do it alone. There's lots to be grateful there. And I think the other thing is perspective. Lots of great perspective. Whenever I think that life is hard or work is hard, I've always have some crazy memory to go back to where it was much harder on a trail or on top of a mountain. Some low that I had was lower than anywhere I'll be sitting behind a desk or working with a group of students or having another job to fill and having to hire or whatever it may be, right? Or a late night in the ER on duty. there's always something tougher to do. And so I sleep really well at night sometimes, just taking myself back to the top of some mountain in a lightning storm and the pouring down rain at 20 degrees, with blistered feet and barely being able to move. And that bed gets really comfortable with that perspective. And you get to see what you're made of.
Excellent. Yeah. What do you have a favorite race that you've run at the ultra level?
There's a lot of great races. I mean, these quote great questions are tough for me. No matter what they are, favorite books and favorite movies, favorite races are tough. I got three races that I'll always remember. The first one, I went to an obstacle course phase in my life, and it was a Spartan race called the Spartan Ultra Beast. Talk about sounding pretty impressive.
Yeah, but that's a cool t-shirt.
Yes, it is. I didn't get the tattoo, but I got the t-shirt, I got the medal. I still have it on my desk. If anybody comes visit, they can ask to look at it. But it was 31 miles, Killington, Vermont, up to the top of the mountain, back many times, usually with a sandbag on your back. And I didn't finish it the first time. Couldn't do it. Goofed off too much, was having fun until I realized there's a time limit for this thing. And I'm not going to make it. but cinched up my belt, worked really hard that next year, and went back and did it. And so that was really great. Boston Marathon is the best. There's just no question. I run a lot of marathons, and Boston's the oldest and the best. So I'm really excited. Never thought I'd be able to run that. You just had to get old enough. That helps. So my time finally qualified me. And I've been able to run it twice, actually. So that's a really great one. And then the pinnacle for me is the Western States 100. That was one of the 100s you were asking about. It is also the oldest and the best 100-miler out in California near Sacramento. It took me 8 years to get into it. It's very difficult to get into. You had to qualify for it. Very difficult race, over 100 miles, point-to-point terrain, through snow and high mountains and 100-plus degree heat and all those kind of things. So you'll see me wearing that belt buckle occasionally around campus, especially on Western Day. I got my buckle.
It is impressive, no doubt about that. So a couple other quick questions here to finish us off. Someone wants to take a long run in Rome, Georgia. What would you recommend?
So trails around Rome for me, it depends on what long is. So the river trail system is amazing. What a great thing for Rome to have. There's lots of ways to do it. But they've just connected up the Armerci connector up above the stadium, and it's a beautiful 7 mile loop now. It's really fun. There's points where you can see into Barry's property, and it's very quiet, and there's points where you go through Ridge Ferry, and there's people everywhere. So that one's great. Barry College is absolute treasure in terms of there's 20,000 acres there, and there are a lot of trails out there. Thank goodness for it. And a lot of people don't know that there's a long distance National Scenic Trail just 30 miles north of here, the Penhody Trail, between sort of going up over the mountain, going to Somerville. It's a 350-mile long trail that connects to the AT, the Appalachian Trail. There are people who walk all the way from Key West, Florida to Canada who traverse just 30 miles or 30-ish minutes north of here. And I've seen them on there, wished them good luck. Saw them in February, and they said they'd be done in October. Does that give you some perspective?
It does. It does. What are some of your favorite places on campus?
Another easy question, probably the trails, right? Mm-hmm. So we have great trails in Coyote, great trails in the back of the mountain. Frankly, my favorite place is probably my house. I mean, I've lived on campus for a long time, and my current abode is the French House, and that's my lakeside house, and I enjoy there, and enjoy the proximity to campus. Those places. Yeah, enjoy running the trails with the cross-country team. A lot of good memories there.
Good. You've lived in Rome a long time now. What are some spots in Rome that you'd recommend for people to visit or enjoy a meal or something like that? What are some favorite places in Rome for the Edies?
We already talked about the trails. Mm-hmm. That's usually where I'm going on foot from here. In terms of restaurants, all the classics. We tend to go to the Schroeder's. We like Blossom Hill nowadays. It's fun to be outside there. We don't eat out a whole lot, but when we go, it's a place like that. Usually some place local that we go to. So, yeah, that's probably about it.
All right, we'll put these together for our Christmas episode later on. A book recommendation?
Oh, see, there we go again. What's your favorite book? That's tough. That's tough. I can tell you some of the recent ones I read.
Yeah, okay, for sure.
So let's see, over the summer I read James, which is a Percival Everett book, a Pulitzer Prize winner, retelling of the Huckleberry Finn story. So really awesome book. Really interesting ending, so you should go read it, just for the ending. A little Quentin Tarantino-esque ending there, so maybe they'll make a movie of that one day. I don't get too excited reading sort of like your professional business books, but I do enjoy them when I do. So like as a team here, that we were talking about department heads earlier, we read the Jim Knight books on instructional coaching, and he's not a researcher. He reads 1,000 books and then pulls them together for education. And so I've been going through his book list. So I just listened to The Advice Trap a couple of weeks ago. And it's a good book. It's basically an entire book that says stop thinking you're so smart and telling people what you think they should do, which is good advice. Yeah, there's that. You know, I read a lot for fun. I like sort of guide books, sci-fi books, and westerns and dystopian books. So you know who's a good author is Larry McMurtry. You probably wouldn't expect me to say that, but I mean, he won a Pulitzer Prize too, right? So for Lonesome Dove.
Western states, you know, it all makes sense. The belt buckle, connection. The Western yep. connection. Absolutely. Yep. I've Lonesome Dove has come up a lot in my life over the summer for some reason. Several people have commented on
really
its brilliance. So yeah. I've got to
it's an impressive
get
book.
Back to that
There's
one as well.
There's something in there for everybody. Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
So on your long runs, do you listen to music? Do you listen to a podcast? Neither?
So if I'm alone, I'm listening to something typically. So I'm usually listening to podcast or a book.
Yeah, so give us one podcast and the best headphones.
So, you know, I listen to a lot of running podcasts while I'm running. So I don't know that our audience will be too terrifically excited about the ultra running podcast. But
you got me hooked on Rich Roll. So, I mean...
I listen to, I listen to news podcasts, some current events, some analysis there. So I like to, you'll find me listening to like Wall Street Journal podcasts. I listen to Pivot, which is a really interesting analysis podcast. I listen to, as far as ultra running goes, there's just some real neat niche stuff out there. But books, that's what I listen to books mostly. I have a hard time sitting down and being still. And so I can listen to books either while I'm running or doing the yard work or those kind of things. So I'm always listening to a book. I'm listening to a Reese Witherspoon book list suggestion. I'm not even going to tell you what it is. You got to go see if you can discover which one it is on her 2025 list. A period piece set in the 60s. So,
okay.
A lot of people don't realize I was an English major. Mm-hmm. You know, like, oh, you must be a technology major. So I like reading all kinds of books.
All right. Excellent. Best headphones?
I had the Shocks.
Shocks.
The Shocks. Okay. It used to be Aftershocks. The Shocks. So the ones that are not earbuds in your ears, the ones that sit on top. So I can hear that car coming and I can jump out of the way.
That's smart. I like to hear that as well. All right, last question. Three people you'd like to have dinner with.
Yeah, I don't like this question either, Brent.
That's why we ask them.
I'm not interested in having dinner with celebrities or people who are famous from the past and all that kind of stuff. So I would be more interested in, you know, being able to have dinner, you know, with, like, family members that have passed. You know, I lost my dad when I was young, so... I'm definitely in that camp. It'd be interesting to see what the heck he was thinking at this point. My grandmother, my mom was very young in her family, so I lost a lot of people over the years. So I was raised by women. That's another interesting sort of probably explanation for how my brain works. So mom was one of four grandmothers and great aunts, and so maybe we could just have one big old dinner party.
Yeah,
with everybody,
with the family.
Count that. Yeah,
that sounds great. That sounds great. You know what? I got to ask you one more.
Hit me. Let's keep talking. This all kind of thing.
This comes. There is. We could do multiple parts of the.
You haven't even asked me about where I grew up.
Of the Stefan Eady podcast, for sure. Where did you grow up?
I was born in Decatur, and I grew up in Stockbridge, Georgia. So okay. Henry County. Yeah. Okay. And so the claim to fame to my high school is just the Stranger Things High School. So if you watch that show where they filmed the school scenes, that was my high school.
So I was as we've been talking, I've been reflecting back on my first encounters with Stefan, and certainly one was during the interview process when I interviewed to be the head of school here. And it was very clear that you were a very highly regarded member of the faculty, both because one of the main questions that Tom Whitworth asked me was what I thought of you, because I needed to have a positive impression if I was going to be successful here. And then later on, at the Brown dinner that year, I was in attendance before I started full time, and you shared a couple of interesting stories at Rick Bice's retirement. So. We'll finish with this. What is the best purchase that you have made at the Unclaimed Baggage?
Yeah, this is a setup question. You know the answer to this. It was my navy blue blazer. My Hart, Schaffner, and Marks blue blazer. That I had one, Rick had one, and actually Marcus Holmes, who worked here for a while, we all acquired it at the same time. And I wore that until the liner fell out last year. Literally last year. This has been a long time ago. And so what do you think that I did to replace it?
I'm hoping you went to Unclaimed Baggage.
That would make a better story. Let's just say that's what I did.
You went to the lodge.
I actually went to eBay.
And oh.
I got my $80 Hart, Schaffner, and Marks blazer.
Yeah. Okay, which someone probably bought from Unclaimed Baggage.
We'll just pretend so. Or maybe I'll sell it there.
Well, let's hope that you don't lose it.
Maybe I'll lose it.
Hopefully you won't lose this one in your luggage. So, well, Stefan, thanks for being with us today. Have enjoyed the conversation and learning a little bit more about you and sharing with our audience about your role here at the school. And we're grateful for all that you do to make Darlington a better place, and excited about this school year and all that it will have to offer. So, again, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks.
We're glad that you tuned in to this episode of Conversations by the Lakeside on the Darlington Podcast. Tune in wherever you like to listen to podcasts, and please subscribe when you have a chance. You can check out today's show notes at www.darlingtonschool.org/podcast.
The Darlington Podcast, a production of Darlington School in Rome, Georgia, is a collaboration between the communication and advancement teams, and the intro music is alumni produced. See show notes and hear more episodes at www.darlingtonschool.org/podcast.